Good evening, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay? No? Yeah? Okay. Welcome tonight to the first of our Young Israel Congregation lectures and the first one to be held in our new building. And we're looking forward. Rabbi Aaron Rakefet is professor of rabbinic literature at Yeshiva University's Carolyn and Joseph Gruss Institute in Jerusalem. He's a noted scholar, author, and teacher who has taught thousands of students throughout his over 55 plus years of teaching. He spent 4 years studying under Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik and remained very close with him afterwards. In 1969, he moved to Israel and worked as a staff editor for the Encyclopedia Judaica. Rabbi Rakefet has always pursued his love of teaching. He was a pioneer in Torah education for diaspora students in Israel. He was a member of the initial 1969 faculty of Jerusalem Torah College, otherwise known as BMT, and taught there for 20 years. He also taught at Machon Gold and Michlala. He was also a founding faculty member of Midrashet Moriah, an advanced Torah study program for women. Rabbi Rakefet had served in the Israel Defense Forces until the maximum allowable age. He served in Lebanon during the 1982 Lebanon War. In 1980, he was recruited by the Mossad's clandestine Nativ operation to teach Torah in the Soviet Union. Rabbi Rakefet visited the Soviet Union in 1981, 1985, and 1989, together with his lovely wife Malka, and recruited 200 others to also visit. His initial visit motivated him to help found the Shvut Ami organization. Rabbi Rakefet felt strongly that a documentary should be made about Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. After much effort, the documentary, The Lonely Man of Faith, The Life and Legacy of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, was first shown in November of 2006. Rabbi Rakefet finished his 10-year effort of writing his personal scholarly memoir, From Washington Avenue to Washington Street, with its publication in 2011. It was his seventh published volume. Rabbi Rakefet continues to devote his talents to the Jewish people and the State of Israel. I have personally known Rabbi Rakefet for over 35 years, ever since he was teaching my children in their Year of Israel Studies programs. His exceptional wisdom, his love of Israel, his ability to bring the values that parents want so much to be imparted into their children makes him a very special and outstanding rabbi, a very special and outstanding teacher. And I personally feel blessed to have him as a very special and very dear friend. It's also very fitting that Rabbi Rakefet's lecture tonight is the first of our series of what we hope will be many in our lecture series to take place in our brand new building. Rabbi Rakefet.
I feel I should be making a Shechiyanu. I know Jackie from many years ago, Woodmere, and go and dream that in the heart of South Florida, such a beautiful, magnificent shul. All I can say is Kol HaKavod, which in Hebrew cannot be equaled in English. I also want to mention, just to protect myself, that all the topics I have spoken about since we got off the plane a week ago, and the topics I'm speaking on tonight and tomorrow night, Friday and Shabbos and Sunday, these topics were selected by the people here in South Florida. The topic I'm about to touch is something that motivates and pulsates within me. Many years ago when I was younger and I thought I could convert the world, I would often dialogue with people to the right of the Yeshiva University spectrum. And the question would always come up, do you celebrate Yom HaTzmaut? And I remember once dealing with representatives of Or Sameach, they threw at me, what happened on Heyiyah that you celebrate? Nothing happened that particular day. Why Heyiyah? Why Vav? Why not Vav Zion, or a month later, or 2 months later? And of course the truth is that any day that you're going to choose, people will say, why Heyiyah? Why this particular date? But I can tell you, two tremendous miracles happened. One actually happened on that date, and one happened as a result of that date. The first miracle, that the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, who we call in Israel, in modern Hebrew, Hazakein, the elder, B.G., Ben-Gurion, had the guts to stand up to the American State Department. Don't underestimate what I just said. We've had many prime ministers subsequently, and we still haven't had one who knew how to stand up or knows how to stand up to the American State Department. Ben-Gurion knew how. So that's a miracle that happened on Heyiyah, the moment he declared the State of Israel, Ashreinu Shezachinu. But there's something else to having a state. A state can accomplish what individuals cannot do. And when you think about the miracles that have occurred to the Jewish people since the destruction of the temple, there is no doubt that having Medinat Yisrael, what's going on in Medinat Yisrael, the Kibbutz Goliath, the gathering of the exiles, this is a great miracle. But there's a second great miracle that we have seen in our own lifetime. A part of the Jewish people that was totally separated, given up for lost, has reawakened, has come home, and has rejoined the Jewish people, the saga of our people, the romance of our people. And this is second only to having a state. And it came about because of the state. And of course, I'm speaking about the lost brethren Jews from Russia who came back. The story I'm about to tell, I could not talk about 10, 15 years ago. I would have been arrested for breach of secrecy. The story I'm about to tell, you no longer have to believe me because I don't believe myself. I write a few chapters about it in the book that's right over there, From Washington Avenue to Washington Street. It went through censorship, etc. But I don't believe it either. But the Mossad published the book about a year and a half ago called Benitiv Hadmama, The Silent Path. I don't believe the Mossad lies when one of their good friends is speaking in Bal Harbor. Think about it. They may tell a fib occasionally in Tel Aviv or Yerushalayim. And in that book, Benitiv Hadmama, when Malka and I walked into the book launch in Mekhar Shazar, who published the book, right in your neighborhood, Vic, that's right where Mekhar Shazar is, the book publisher, a few hundred people jumped on us and said, Atema kol chavim, you're the stars of the book. We looked at them and lo and behold, two little kids from the Bronx were the stars of the book. The story begins with a kibbutznik named Aryeh Kroll. Aryeh Kroll becomes the second most important person I ever met in my life, a source of great inspiration. Number one is Mori Urebi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Number two is Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Aryeh Kroll was a kibbutznik, one of the founders of Kibbutz Sad, which has been in the news for years now, right opposite the Arabs, right opposite the southern border. And Aryeh Kroll had come to Palestine in the mid-30s. His father had preceded him, 33. Aryeh and his mother arrived in 35. His father was a shochet. They were people from what we would call White Russia. Aryeh Kroll went to Bnei Akiva, got involved with Kibbutz Sad, Haganah, Palmach. At the end of 25 years in the kibbutz and playing a central role in the kibbutz, those of you who know kibbutz, everything is socialistic, communistic. The kibbutz met and they said to Aryeh, "You are entitled to travel overseas. The kibbutz will pay for you. Pick a country." And Aryeh very innocently said, not realizing how this would change to a certain degree the course of history for the Torah people, said, "I'd like to go to Russia to visit my two sisters who survived the Holocaust." And the kibbutz said, "Fine." At that time, 1965, there were relations with Russia. You could go, Israelis could go, the Israeli passport was welcomed. And Aryeh Kroll joins a group of Israelis visiting Russia, comes, and Aryeh told me he forgot most of his Russian. At first he had difficulty understanding it, speaking it, but soon your childhood language comes back to you. And he's now in communist Russia with a group of Israelis, and they're looking around the streets of Moscow. Hundreds of thousands of Jews live in Moscow. Perhaps even 1 million Jews were there at that time. But all you have is one synagogue, what the communists called the functioning synagogue. The median age was 85. KGB Jewish agents are there. You don't see any youth. And it was very depressing. And one night he gets back to the hotel. The group gets back. They go upstairs. They go to sleep. It's about 10 o'clock at night. And suddenly there's a knock on Aryeh Kroll's door. And a hard knock. He thought it was the KGB. He opens the door. And there is a woman who is part of the group from Israel. And she says to Aryeh, "My brother has just arrived from Novosibirsk. He traveled days to meet me. Families were separated by the Holocaust. The lady was living in Israel years already, decades. The brother, who is older and still in Russia, came to meet her with a tzaris and a talis, with a talis that was ripped, that was tattered, that had bloodstains on it. And he told his sister, 'This talis protected me during World War II. This talis protects me in Siberia. If only I could get a new Israeli talis, I would wrap myself up in it and tell the Ribbono Shel Olam, whenever you take me, see to it that I'm buried in this talis.'" And Aryeh Kroll was overwhelmed. He gave the man his talis, gave the sister, "Give this to your brother. I'll get a talis when I get back to Israel." And the next day they had a meeting with the ambassador to Russia, Yosef Takoa, and they wrote notes back and forth because everything is being listened to in Russia, in communist Russia. And he wrote to the ambassador, "I cannot believe it, but Jews still remember that they are Jews. give us whatever trinkets you have. And the ambassador gave him a few hundred little Magen Davids and emblems of Jerusalem and Israel. And wherever they went and met Jews, they gave it out and people grabbed and pleaded for more. And Aryeh Kroll comes back to Israel, as he often said, I left one person, I came back a different person. And Aryeh, who was then the Maskir Klali, the executive director, I would use in English, of Kibbutz Sad, made an appointment to see the old man, the CBG, who had retired to his kibbutz in the Negev, Stay Boker, and he goes to see BG. And he tells BG, I'm living it in Hebrew, I'm trying to say it in English, but it's hard for me because I speak three languages, all with a Bronx accent, but when I talk about history, I relive it. So he goes to see Ben-Gurion, and Ben-Gurion says to Aryeh, I thought you were smart. You're a fool. You think you're going to wake up Russian Jewry and bring them back. All right, you gave out at college, you gave out a few trinkets. What are you going to do? Since 1917, no shuls, no rabbis, no yeshiva, no melamdim. Forget it. And Aryeh goes back to his kibbutz very disappointed. About 2 weeks later, middle of the night, Aryeh Kroll already is in pajamas, in his bed. Suddenly there's a heavy knock on the door, and a woman is running. She says, Aryeh, Aryeh, yesh. There was one telephone in the kibbutz, in the maskirut. That's where the telephone was, the secretariat office. Aryeh, yesh tzulksul b'shvilcha v'yomrim shezeh ma'od chashuv. There's a call for you, and they say it's very important. And Aryeh Kroll tells me he put on a bathrobe, he went running, and he comes, he picks up the phone, and the person says, Ata Aryeh Kroll, you're Aryeh Kroll? Yesh lecha chaver tov b'kibbutz Stay Boker. You have a good friend in Stay Boker. He says, Hu bikesh mimeni letzalzel elecha? He asked me to call you. Shmi Shaul Avigur. If you don't know that name, make believe you do, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Warren, I only teach wise students. In my class, you gotta say you know that name among some others as well. Those of you who sort of forgot the name, look it up on the Wikipedia, the Encyclopedia Judaica. Shaul Avigur was the legendary head of Aliyah Bet. He brought all the children who survived that had to be smuggled into Israel, smuggled around the British. That's Shaul Avigur, one of the founders of the Mossad. So Avigur, Aryeh told me he was shaking. You know, that's like for me to get a call from the Rav. The Rav wants to see you. Shaul Avigur wants to see him. He goes to see Avigur, and Avigur says, all right, Aryeh, from this moment on, I'm going to reveal secrets to you, which you're not allowed to tell anyone. The Mossad has had a branch dealing with Soviet Jewry since 1952. It is called Nativ Lishkat HaKesher. It means a path, an office to keep in touch with the Jews in Russia. But we like your spirit, and we're going to invite you into our operation. Tell the kibbutz you have to take a leave of absence. And Aryeh Kroll starts to work in North Tel Aviv, Rehov Mendel at 23, which doesn't exist today. The whole area was knocked down. It's a park and a shopping area. Sarona, it was just opened a few months ago, if not weeks. And Aryeh Kroll starts working there. 1967, the war breaks out, and those of you who recall what happened right after the Six-Day War, Russia breaks relations with Israel. No Israeli passport can get to Russia. Aryeh Crow was the genius who understood what Time magazine actually wrote about this in the, must be late 70s. Israel has the greatest potential percentage of spies more than any other country in the world. Because at that time, about 40% of the Israeli population had dual citizenship. Now, let me explain to you. Dual citizenship is not sufficient. It means someone like Aaron Rakefet. I speak Bronx English. I get off the plane. First thing I do in the summer, how are the Yankees doing? You know the mentality. So you can pass for an American. The first couple that Aryeh sent to Russia were two English kids who worked on Kibbutz Adati, B'nai Akiva kids, who had English citizenship. They were the first ones. The grandchild of one of them married into my brother's family. I met him at the wedding, a legendary figure. They came back. They met. They were active. They influenced. They reminded the Jews in Russia, the Jewish people are yet alive. And this began a whole operation under Aryeh Crow. He later wins Pras Yisrael for the whole concept he came up with of dual citizenship, sending people to Russia to remind the Jews we are still alive despite the Holocaust. Don't believe what you hear from the communist regime about Israel and its survival. In 1980... minding my own business, a little bit frightened. My father, Zichrono Livracha, was very ill. It was the tail end of his illness. May of 80, the phone rings. I jump for the telephone, and the lady gets on, and she says, Harav Rakefet, Ani Yom Mekein. I answer, yes. By the way, what I'm mentioning now is written up word by word, not only in Washington, but in the Mossad book and a big article that appeared when the Mossad book came out in one of the Israeli newspapers, Makor Rishon. And the conversation went like this. Harav Rakefet, ata mukhan lekabel sicha b'li legalot et pratei ha-sicha. Are you willing to accept a phone call, but you cannot tell anyone what this phone call is about? A lady is saying it to me. I have to be honest with you, I've gotten calls like that. Generally, it's students who are doing terrible sins, and they think I'm a Catholic priest, that we can absolve them. So I figured, I don't want to go into more details, there's an Aram Kodesh behind me. I figured it's one of these stupid calls, but if you were once my student, I have to answer you. Even if I have to tell you what you're doing is wrong and terrible, and you have to turn to God and straighten up your life. So she puts on Aryeh, and Aryeh says, Harav Rakefet. And until today, I have no idea how he got to me. I always asked him, he would never tell me. I say, Rav Rakefet, Anachna yodim shata yodei chlala meid daf gemara. We know that you know how to teach a daf gemara. Would you be willing to teach gemara in Moscow? All right. Who will you take with you? I say, my wife. As I remember, Aryeh says, Yafeh, good. What about your three daughters? That he lists out my daughters, their age, our daughters, their age. I start shaking. I see this is not a crank call. This is the real McCoy. So I told Aryeh, look, we have family here. My eldest daughter's already a teenager. Okay. And he made up a meeting place difficult to find. Only in retrospect that I realized that that was done purposely, because I would have to find difficult addresses in communist Russia in the heart of winter. You're sitting here in Florida today. In New York, they're freezing. Compared to Russia, in New York, they're in Florida. You understand? I know what to do. Oh boy, what weather in Russia? We had to find the address. Malka and I found the address, and we were briefed. We obviously had already gone through the security check, because you see how much Arye knew about me, or knew about us. I just have to keep a watch in front of me. I see you trust your rabbi. I don't see a clock in front of me here. When I was in the rabbinate, I had a shtender. When I get up to speak, the president would press a button. At the end of 18 minutes, it collapsed. You understand? So Baruch Hashem, thank God, I left the rabbinate and went in Aliyah. Began a series of briefings, and I have to be honest with you, we were scared out of our wits. I never got a ticket in my life. I did basic training at the age of 38. I was the Chayil Mitztayein. I won two awards for sharpshooting. I do things when I have to do it, I do it seriously. But to go to communist Russia, not so simple. You'll ask, didn't the Russians know what you were doing? Absolutely. But if they expelled you, the State Department kept track. The minute 10 Americans were expelled, they would expel 10 Russian tourists from the United States. So there was tit for tat. There was a certain balance of the cat and mouse here. Live and let live, or spy versus spy, if you remember Mad Comics. January of 1980... Malka and I leave for Russia. We're under a false address in the United States, living in Queens. I have to pick a profession, and Arye Kroll said to me, you have to pick a profession that you'll feel comfortable with, in the sense that the KGB cannot challenge you. So, of course, if I say I'm a lawyer, they'll put a lawyer against me, and what am I going to do? Quote Masechet Sanhedrin and Hilchot Toin V'Nitan. I'm finished. If I say I'm a medical doctor, I'm not my brother. My brother could be a medical doctor. There is a medical doctor, but I can't say I'm a medical doctor. So the Gemara Cup worked, and I picked a fabulous profession. You can see a picture of my stationery in Washington. The co-director of Freedom Finance Company in Staten Island. The Gross family, my good friends. Russians know nothing about money. I may know nothing, but they know even less. So if I'm co-director of Freedom Finance Company, I am safe. So we come in and, leave it to the Mossad. I don't elaborate too much, but we get off the plane in France. All our Israeli identity is taken away, and we get boarding passes as if we got on the plane in JFK. Arrived in Paris, and from Paris the next day on air float, we go on into communist Russia. It was difficult point of entry. They take you apart. They're looking for your phone book with the names, the people you want to visit. They take it away. They photograph it. They know just what they're doing. But Malka, unknown to me, I thought I was memorizing names. She opened up the lining of my coat, and with certain ink that you can write on fabric, she wrote in the names, the telephone numbers, resold the lining, the Shalom al Yisrael. Finally, at the end of an hour and a half, we reach Moscow. Reached the hotel by about 2 o'clock. It's January. I went between terms when no one would miss me. No one would ask questions. It's a perfect period for a teacher to go. And I cannot tell you, the next morning, we're hunting for the synagogue, which was in walking distance of what was then the Inn Tourist Hotel, right next to the Kremlin. We find the synagogue, the only functioning synagogue, Achapova Street, the Choral Synagogue it was called. And we come to the entrance, and if you recall, there's a famous picture of Golda Meir, the first ambassador to Russia, 1948, where she announces she's coming to the shul, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and 50,000 Russian Jews turned out to greet her. Stalin went berserk. This is where he coined the plan ultimately to send all the Jews to concentration camps in Siberia, and God called them in before he could enact his evil decrees. He was furious. And there's the famous picture of Golda that was on Israeli money, the bill that had her face on it, her portrait. On the other side was the picture of Golda standing in front of the entrance of the synagogue, surrounded by Russian Jews. Ein zeh ki im beit Elokim v'zeh shar hashamayim. Yaakov's dream. And Malka and I have a picture of us standing in that exact place under that exact pasuk. At that moment, we found the shul. We came back Friday night. We came back Shabbos morning. And I'm starting to make my contacts. I'm looking around. And who can I speak to? I don't see the people I had seen in pictures. And a certain Dr. Kogan, who I felt intuitively I could trust. And speaking Yiddish, of course, which, if those of you who heard my lecture last Friday night in North Miami Beach, how does it come to a third generation American whose parents were born in Holland to be fluent in Yiddish? And this was the miracle of Sempo Sugihara, Zeche Tzadik Levracha, saved the Mir Yeshiva. And beginning with seventh grade on, my Rebbeim didn't speak a word of English, I didn't speak a word of Yiddish, but our hearts met. So Yiddish became so important to me. Zog zu Dr. Kogan, ich guck, ich will sehen Essas. Ich sehe nicht an Schule. I'd like to see Essas. I had the name. I revealed it to him. His face lights up. It's my Rebbe. No, you won't see him here today. He lives too far from the shul. Tonight, you come back after Mariv, right at the train station, the metro, right up the block, you're going to see hundreds and hundreds of refusnikim that meet every Saturday night to exchange information. And I came back, and I was introduced to Roman Kaplan. They all live in Israel today. And Kaplan took me to Eliyahu Essas, and I was introduced to the world of the Tsarivnikim, the Refusnikim. Now, what happened here? What happened here is very simple. Had the Russian Empire let them out when they wanted to get out, they would have been like all the other Jews in Israel. All right, you come back to being a Jew, Jewish identity, Zionism, call it what you wish, Jewish nationalism. Tell me, did Ben-Gurion put on tefillin every day? Did Ben-Gurion daven? I hope there's no Chabatnik here, because when I say this, I have Chabatnikim in my class. I mentioned the other a few weeks ago, I said, I'd be much happier if I knew that Netanyahu put on tefillin every morning, and the Chabatnikim shoot back at me. Of course, Rebbe, of course he puts on tefillin, all right? Halavai that they're right. They would have been like all the other Jews, but they didn't let them out. And when a Jew suffers, he starts to ask questions. Manishtana, why are we different? Why do we suffer? Why does the world hate us? Why do we have an Obama and self-hating Jews? These are good questions. And they started to open up a chumash. And they saw who we are, what we are. And they were learning chumash in Russia. They had in various libraries chumashim with Russian translation. Many of these refusnikim had PhDs. They had access to the Lenin Library. You have chumashim. You have a Tanakh. Slowly but surely, kahati mishnayos was smuggled in. If you know Hebrew, you can learn mishnayot. In late 1980, they sent back a message to Israel, we want classes in Gemara. And what I began, and because, thank God, Malka and I were successful, I worked for the Mossad, talking 10 years. The chain began in 1981 January. There was never a period where we didn't have four individuals in Russia, two couples, the men capable of teaching Gemara, and the chain continued. Where I left off, the next couple picked up exactly at the sentence I left off. By the time many of these refusnikim got out, they were wonderful Talmidei Chachamim who could match any yeshiva high school graduate in greater Florida. Now I want to ask you a question. You can't talk too much in Russia. Yeah, you can talk all you want about the Yankees, the Red Sox, the World Series, the Maggio, Ted Williams, the unusual, Meyer, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, Duke Snyder. All you want, you can talk. But about serious Jewish Torah matters, you cannot talk freely. You're being listened to. So how do you tell these Russians who you are? How do you convey that message? Watch the way the Mossad worked. Every 2 years, there was a book fair in Moscow. In order for the book fair to take place, Israel had to be allowed in. It's like international sports competition. Arab countries have been forced to allow Israeli teams in occasionally. Alach kama v'kama a fortiori, if I can use a fancy English word, a kal v'choma. If you have a book fair, you have to have a division of Israel. The Mossad would see to it that the best people were picked to come in as experts in books, publishers. They had personality. They were alive. They had to be able to speak not just Russian, Hebrew, obviously, English, Yiddish. These were personalities par excellence. So all Malka and I had to do, this was part of our briefings, the names on this list that we're giving you, these are the people you say, Yeshli Drishat Shalom B'Shvilcha Meshmuel Chatzar. We had to memorize the name Shmuel Chatzar. I didn't know who Shmuel Chatzar was from a hole in the ground. But when I got back, and a minute I would say Shmuel Chatzar, their faces would light up. And they knew exactly who you were and where you were coming from and who was sending you. Shmuel Chatzar was the head of the delegation at the book fair in 1980. And every 2 years there's a book fair, and every 2 years you had a different name, the shluchim going on in. I'm talking like a chabadnik, shluchim, the shluchim going in, all were told. Jackie Gluck was here at the book fair 2 years ago. He headed up the Israeli delegation. Regards from Jackie Gluck. You mentioned his name. Their faces lit up. You understand? They knew everything within a second. That was part of it. Another part, and I reveal secrets that I never thought I would ever talk about in public, but time has marched on. The security clause is lifted. Money. What the Mossad did. Here, we were citizens of Israel. I'll be honest with you, we went in Aliyah 47 years ago. We were poor American kids. There's someone sitting here, Professor Rothkopf, no relation, but a good friend. He will testify how poor we were. 69, 70, don't ask after the Yom Kippur War. Not that they cut your salary, they just took it all away in war bonds. And suddenly, we have thousands of dollars in our hands. to give to the wives of the prisoners of Zion, Tatiana Edelstein, Zichrona Levracha, Yudel Edelstein, who owns Israel today, Speaker of the House, the Knesset. We had thousands of dollars. We would go into the Beryuska, the foreign currency shop with her, and purchase liquor that she would use to give to the guards in jail to allow the kosher food which we brought in to be given to Yuli Edelstein. You see, more than that, there was a person in Yerushalayim, Hasharovsky. No one was more trusted by the Mossad than Hasharovsky. He only got out of Russia in 1989, 1990, at the very, very end of this period. You instructed, there's a picture, I believe it's either in Washington or in the Mossad book, where I'm talking with Yuli Hasharovsky in the snow. We wouldn't speak in the house. We went out to a park. You give him $10,000 in cash. All that money went to get the finest lawyers for the prisoner of Zion's and their trials. Another example, Arya gives me a picture of a woman, a lady. What lady? Maybe 30 years old. He says, Rav Aaron, when you get to Vilna, you're going to look up these people. Gives us, it's a doctor. You'll meet him and you'll contact him this telephone. Work out to meet him. And you show him this picture. I say, what does it mean? And he explained to me. I show him the picture. Gives me the equivalent of $100,000 in rubles. His daughter had gone in Aliyah. The Mossad bought an apartment for her. The father was a very well-known medical doctor, our heart specialist. He had made a fortune of money, I imagine part of it under the table. He was already informed by his daughter, someone will show you my picture. In another phone call, she probably added a few more details. The minute I show him the picture, he now owes the Mossad the equivalent of $100,000. Gives me the money. I take the money to the people that I'm told to give it to, and this money will cover the study of Hebrew, Torah, and Jewish history for the next year in the greater Vilna area. And these people are informed, in 6 months' time, someone will come and ask you for a detailed report of how you utilized the money. And you know what the money essentially went for? You couldn't use a mimeograph machine or a Xerox machine. They were all under government control. They would know exactly what you are Xeroxing. But no one can stop you from setting up a photography. Today you don't even know what I'm talking about. When we were kids, we used to take film and develop it on our own. I did it myself. And you would print pictures. You set up a photography lab in your basement, which was joint property. It had to be Jews who could be trusted. And you would take endless pictures of texts. The minute you have a picture of a Daf Gemara, you publish 1,000 copies. The minute you have a picture of Menachem Begin's book, The White Knights, which they loved in Russia, or Exodus, which was, quote, end quote, a bestseller in the Refusnik community, you take a picture, no one but no one can interfere. They will basically never know. And these are just some small examples of what went on. In 85, in London, the Mossad gave us a very expensive camera. Remember, there were once real cameras with all types of attachments. I didn't know the first thing about it. They told me, you'll figure out on the plane. I said, what are you, crazy? I'm going to figure out on the plane. That's all I need to do. We have to assume there's spies going into Russia on the plane. I said, you know what? If they bother me, I'll just tell them it's a brand new camera. I'll learn as I use it. So here they are taking us apart, and Malka has the camera on the floor. And as they're going through the suitcases and questioning us, she's kicking it. 1 inch, 2 inch, 3 of absolute truth, every syllable I'm telling you. When we're finished at the counter, an hour later, there's the camera on the floor. They tell us, okay, you can go. The driver's waiting to take you to the hotel. She lifts up her suitcase, lifts up the camera, and that camera covered the study. If you know the Polanski group in Moscow, they told me for 2 years they sold it on the black market. Wow, communist Russia, to be able to get a camera like that. Everything was black money. And for 2 years they had all their costs covered. But it wasn't so simple. Our greatest task was to find people that we felt, first of all, were intelligent, knew how to teach Gemara, above all, knew how to keep a secret. And you got to find them. I have to mention my dearest friend, no longer alive, Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Groner, Professor Groner, worked with us in the briefing. I would find them, among them my students who couldn't say no to me. And they had to be briefed, and they're briefed by the Mossad. And the first time you go, you can't get enough briefing in because you're, you know, a little bit frightened. And you have to go through a security check. So I would meet with Aryeh once a week, once every 10 days. It all was around my army schedule. No one knew where I was going. I would telegram, I'm going to the army. I have to lecture today, which was true. But I didn't tell them the lecture was over by 12 noon. The maskiratim, the army, who were all from Eidat HaMizrach at that time, and their love of Rabbanim is indescribable. And Kvod HaRav, Shemanu HaTzach, Haitam Mashu, Mashu, your lecture was something. Bon, Tishtet, Tochal. I would have a nice cup of coffee, some good cake, and then I would go across the street to the Russian center, and I would present Aryeh with the information to start the security check, the couple I want to send, the name of the husband, the name of the wife, the address, the age, where they work, etc. Oh boy, occasionally I had real problems. A pleasant problem was when I presented the names of a couple from Chicago, I come back, about a month later we get the results, and Aryeh tells me they can't go. I say, why can't they go? He says, their son is a pilot in the Israeli Air Force. These are great people, but if your son is a pilot, you're a security risk. Because we have to assume the KGB knows who your son is, and maybe you have information which we can beat out of you. But one time I pick a couple, Malka and I pick a couple, and he was a rabbi. I want you to identify him. An American rabbi. We taught together in 69, 70, 71. And I, a chevraman, you know, tall and strong. I figured he's going to be great. But he had left teaching Torah. And he told me he wants to make money. He went into becoming a kablan, a builder. So I come back. Aryeh Kroll, about a month later, I walk into Aryeh's office. What kind of friends do you have? I look at him, and he throws the report from the Mossad at me. And this guy was arrested for schita be'iyumim in Hebrew, extortion in English. There was no trial yet. He's either guilty or innocent, but he was arrested. That's a security factor. So I say to Aryeh, Mani Agidlo, what will I tell him? I can't go back and tell him I found out you've been arrested, the extortion. So Aryeh says, Zot habaya shelcha, that's your problem. So I say, Tov, Tainli Atadok, give me the report from the Mossad. And I look at it. So I take a look. I again, I'm standing in front of an Aron Kodesh. I don't tell fibs in front of an Aron Kodesh, particularly when I'm in Bal Harbor. This is exactly true. Following the Yom Kippur War, before the Yom Kippur War, the army did not bother anyone with dual citizenship. An American, they didn't bother you. The State Department objected. After the Yom Kippur War, they took everyone. So they took a whole bunch of Americans, late 30s. I want to be honest with you. I found a place in the army. I don't want to put myself down. I did some good work in the army. But what do you do with Americans who, they're not lecturers, they're not teachers? So they had a real problem. And Americans, you know, are not stupid. They say, "No man, man, not nasev. What are we going to do? What's going to be with us? You called us up. You gave us training. What's going to be?" So they told the Americans, "We're doing a special course in spotting planes." Does anyone remember this? They took a whole group. Now, I was out of it. I already was in the lecture corps of the army. Took a whole group of my friends. Took them out of work for about a week, and in Bada Baba, Sis Hadrachad Dalit in Betel, it doesn't exist anymore. They had to lay on the floor with their guns, like they're lying on a high position on a roof, and the commander would say, 3 o'clock means the plane is coming at 3 o'clock, you point your gun to shoot the plane. 6 o'clock, 12 o'clock, they did this course. And they put them, if you know Yerushalayim, the old building, it belonged to the Histadrut, right at the entrance to Meir Sharim. Today it's a Haredi building, but then it was one of the tallest buildings in Yerushalayim. Every week they would station two stupid Americans on the roof with their guns, watching for approaching aircraft. So I have to meet with this rabbi now, and I'm praying to the Ribbono Shel Olam, help me out. And I say to him, "Tell me, Avraham, did you do a course in the army with anti-aircraft?" "Yeah, crazy, stupid, on the roof with our guns, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Anyone who did that course can't go to Russia for 20 years. That's a very secret course." What could he say? Couldn't say a word. And that's how I solved the problem. I met him many years later in Haifa on Chol HaMoed Sukkos with his late wife. And I said to Malka, "Oh boy, I may be in trouble, but Baruch Hashem." And let me go one step further. I want to pull it together. Let me go one step further and let you understand the psychology behind being a Jew and what is important or not. One of the greatest couples I sent to Russia, these were two men. Of course, their wives had little children. They were little children, and you don't want to send a woman when they're little children at home. One of them was my dearest friend, world famous, God have mercy on us, Rabbi Dr. David Applebaum, who later is killed with his daughter. She had already gone to mikveh for her wedding. The night before her wedding, David, it breaks the heart. And send David, world-class Talmud Chacham, Talmud Mufak of Rabbanan Soloveitchik, world-class emergency medical doctor who changed the course of medicine in the state of Israel with his establishing Terem, the emergency rooms all over the country today, not just in a hospital. And he goes, well, a laid-back individual, Zalman Deutsch. They're good friends, Zalman Deutsch from Muncie, if you know the family. He's an architect, not a personality like David, but a chazan, a very good chazan. And they go, send a couple, go all over, come back. I write about them, and I write about this incident in Washington. A few years later, one of the famous refusnikim gets out, Isaac Kogan of Leningrad. Izzy Kogan gets out, and the boss, Arye Kroll, we refer to as the boss, we would never use his name for fear the KGB is listening, And the boss calls me, he says, Rav Rakefet, Higia Hashalach Abeidotcha Vashluchim Shalcha, the time has come to honor you and those people you sent and risked their lives and well-being. Yitzchak Hogan, you know, is getting out, he's coming, this and this day, this and this time. We're going to make a big reception in the VIP lounge in Lod, and give me a list of the people you want admitted. I say, fine. Give a list, and of course David and Zalman are among them, because they had been in Leningrad in Yitzchak's house, and now you can see the sight. The room is filled with politicians, with newspaper reporters, with Rakefet and his cohorts. And suddenly there is Yitzchak, the Israeli TV is going crazy. Here's a man coming out of Russia with a beard down to his belt, with the whole Hasidic department, Lubavitch, Mitagatl, walking with his wife, Zichrona Levracha, Tzadeket, Sophia, his three daughters. He has a son in Israel. And he looks at me, well, Shalom Aleichem. Looks at David Applebaum, Shalom Aleichem. He sees Zalman. Zalman, fine gone a little, ich hab schlangewart, sich herin euch noch einmal. Start a song. I waited a long time to hear you again. And there is Zalman starting the song. I said to David afterwards, we me liggin in dread. I can't translate that. We're guys like us, we know how to learn, we give shayurim, you're a world-class medical doctor. The chazan trances us 9-0. And it was unbelievable. Fine gonna start a song. I waited so long to hear you. All right. These are some of the stories. I can go on endlessly. When Yom HaTzmut comes, I say Hallel B'Levu Nefesh. You cannot imagine the miracles that Malcolm, myself, and I have to say my children and grandchildren, I hope even the great-grandchildren already have a little seichel. We appreciate what God has vouchsafed unto us in the last 70 years. Who would ever believe that after decades of separation from everything Jewish and Taridic, the Russian people could wake up? I want to describe to you, read a description, appeared originally in the Jerusalem Post. We were in Russia at the time. It was 1989. The thaw was beginning. And Gorbachev had allowed the opening of a secular Jewish cultural center in Moscow, named after Shlomo Mikhails, who was murdered by Stalin in the early 50s. He was one of the Jewish intelligentsia. He was an actor, ran the theater, the Yiddish theater. And Stalin had a whole slew murdered, including Shlomo Mikhails. Australia played a big part in this. A fellow from Australia who had contacts, very well to do, a big tourist agency, Izzy Leibler, or Liebler. And the communist government agreed to open the Solomon Mikhail's Center. People came in from all over the Jewish world. Marvin Hayer was there, from all over Israel. Shlomo Mikhail's daughter came in from Israel. It was really an magnificent affair. And with it went a big concert in a hall in Moscow. And the greatest Israeli performers came in to sing. And this is the description from the Jerusalem Post. Then Yaffa Yakoni sang Naomi Shemer's 1967 anthem, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Held in thrall by Yakoni's hauntingly mystical rendition of the song, the audience reached the threshold and beyond as the melody seemed to conjecture in the hall a near sacred vision of Jerusalem for an audience to which the holy city had been as distant as the moon. Turning in my seat, I saw elderly World War II veterans, their mouths filled with gold teeth and their chests ablaze with rows of service medals, crying uncontrollably. A lifetime of Soviet education and anti-Semitic propaganda had been unsuccessful in pulverizing the invisible bonds between these men and the Jewish people. Now, late in life, they were being given a chance in the very citadel of the Soviet Empire to openly manifest their love for Israel and things Jewish. The power of the moment was so overwhelming that it swept aside all political, religious, and cultural differences, uniting everyone in the hall in a mystic halo of shared Jewishness. A cultural activist turned in his seat and, half embracing me, an Israeli Jew, said simply, "Tov lihiyot Yehudi." It is good to be a Jew. A three-word mantra that aptly and fully summed up the transcendental Jewish magic unleashed that night in Tchaikovsky's hall. Yakloni closed with Heivenu Shalom Aleichem and then returned for what seemed 5 or 6 curtain calls with an audience that was ecstatic. I don't believe there's been a more successful Aliyah than the Russian Aliyah. They have taken over the country to a certain degree. Every famous politician today, from Sharansky and Edelstein and all the others, many of them wearing kippot. We have problems, but every Aliyah brings problems. We have about 350,000 Russians who are Mizera Beit Yisrael of Jewish descent, but are not halachically Jewish. I need not tell you, I've given more than a year and a half worth of Sheurim in the Kollel in my Sunday class on Geirut and Giyur and the laws. We can discuss it sometime. But we also have tens of thousands of Balei Tshuva. And let me tell you a little story that happened to us. It's in the book. Yitzchak Kogan had only daughters in Russia. And Israel is blessed with a son, Ben Sekunim. 13 years later, I get a call. I hear the Russian accent. Rav Aaron, we're making a bar mitzvah. We want you and Malka to come. Malka and I came, and Rabbi Merzel of Chorev, Zecher Zichron Levracha Shlomo, and his wife came. And we were the only non-Russians. I had sent the Merzels to Russia, Rivka and Shlomo, and they had done wonderful work there and became very supportive. Anytime I needed a favor with education, with Russian children, they were there. And we're the only non-Russians. They were also the only ones in this room of about 300 people without beards, clean shaven. Everyone else had a beard. They had every type of yarmulke under the sun. Srugot, black, strimels, big black hats. And then they gave a clap. Tfilat Marav b'mistaron, outside in the foyer, we're going to daven Marav. And we went out with these Russians, two American kids. We both grew up in Bnei Akiva, North America. Shlomo was the head of Bnei Akiva in North America, and I was a kid. And we begin davening Maariv, and I want to tell you, I thought it was Maariv Erev Yom Kippur, the way these Russians davened, with such kavana, with such feeling, with such meaning. Ashrei Ayin Ra'atazot. Happy are the eyes that had the privilege to see this. But I'll go one step further. What's happened in Russia today, it defies imagination. And I want to read a speech that was just given, part of the speech. I have a printout of it. This was just given a few weeks ago by a Russian leader. And this little story has such musa to it, how a Jew has to be a gomel chesed. I will tell you a small story which took place in St. Petersburg about 50 years ago. A young non-Jewish boy grew up in a very poor family. Those times, most people lived in communal apartments, which had different rooms for families and shared kitchens and living area. Malk and I saw this in Russia, of course. This boy had poor parents who were barely home. He was fortunate that a neighboring family from another room in the apartment started inviting him over. The father was a professor who helped him with his homework. They babysat for him. He was a young boy. The family, who was Jewish, also invited him for the Friday night Shabbat meals. He remembers how they used to take out old books and read from these books after the meal. At that time, the boy said, "Look how impressive these Jewish people are. They never fight with each other. There is respect between the husband and wife. A beautiful family to emulate." Can anyone tell me who I just quoted? The president of the Soviet Union, Vladimir Putin. I'll go even further. He's a Chabotnik, Putin. One time when Mr. Sharon was visiting Mr. Putin, the meeting was taking much longer than expected. Every so often, someone would walk into the meeting with a small piece of paper. Mr. Putin would say a few words in Russian, and the person would leave. A few minutes later, someone else walked in with another piece of paper. The president tells him something, and the person walks out. On the third time, Arik Sharon turns to President Putin and says, "When in Israel someone comes in during an important meeting with a piece of paper, it's a sign that something terrible has happened to the country. Did anything happen? Should we cut the meeting short?" The president said, "Actually, the staff realized that the meeting is taking longer than expected. They felt that we should break for lunch. I told them, 'You're the Prime Minister of Israel. You certainly want a kosher meal.' And I was giving them instructions how to put together a kosher meal." And you see, he is a Chabotnik. Let us not talk about Arik Sharon and his religious practices. My dear friends, to summarize, and I'll conclude with the Devar Torah. So I could speak on this topic, believe me, you would all be asleep, but it'd be tomorrow morning, we'll be putting on talis and tefillin. But I hope I did a little justice to the topic. When you look back, you know, you think, what are the great achievements of your life? And thank God, for a little kid from the Bronx, we're doing okay. But this is certainly one of them. It's an amazing story. Aryeh Krolg gets all the credit. He was the genius. he discovered the dual passports, how he got to the people he got, Chavre mevi Chavre, Chavre isle Chavre, the Lashon of Tosfot, everyone has a friend. I still don't know how he got to me, but he got to many others. And I was in a position, as is explained in the Mossad book, because of my teaching and all the people I knew in Israel and how long I had been in Israel at the time, I was able to be very helpful. We kept this chain going, and we were privileged to see the reawakening and all that came with the fall of the communist empire. But I have to tell you, it is very painful for me to speak here tonight. I often tell my students, when you go back to America, you have to bite your tongues. How can it be that there's still Jews who care about Judaism and Torah living outside the reborn state of Israel? Hard to understand it. We went through a Holocaust, we went through a Shoah, we were saved by Raoul Wallenberg. And boy, do we owe the Ribbono Shel Olam a debt. And part of it is going in Aliyah, following the example of Avraham Avinu, Lech Lecha, Miyatzecha, Mimolatcha, Mibeit Avicha. I explained this in detail. The order is wrong, but we'll leave that for what I said in North Miami Beach. The French Jews today in Yerushalayim, I speak three languages. I'm going to have to learn a fourth in order to survive, and that is French. The joke making the rounds, I told it at dinner earlier, when in the only time you hear French and hear Hebrew in Rechavia or Katamon is when a French Olé meets an American Olé. That's the only time you hear Hebrew. Either you hear English or you hear French. The American Jew doesn't have to run to Israel. The French are running, frightened, can't wear a kippah in public day after day. If you follow the websites, the news, it doesn't make the New York Times, but it has to make the heart of the Jewish Times. American Jews can yet come in dignity, kol miyot. And I want to end off a pasuk in Yeshayahu, to me perhaps the most important pasuk in all of Nach. We say it on Rosh Hashanah. In the Shofrat, Yeshaya, Perik Chavzayin, Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'haya Bayom Hahu, Yitaka B'Shofa Gadol, U'bahu Avdim B'Yeretz Ashur, V'hanidachim B'Yeretz Mitzrayim, V'shtachavu LaHashem B'har HaKodesh B'Yerushalayim. On that great day, the shofar will be sounded. And the Jews that were lost in Eretz Ashur, you know what that means? Land of plenty. Osha. The Anglo countries. No one is persecuting us. And yet we have gone totally lost here. No one pushing us away. But where there's no Torah, over 90% intermarriage. An article just appeared mocking by a Jew, mocking Brit Mila. We don't have to go any further than the Secretary of State, whose real name is Cohn, and he became, or his parents became, Baal Keris. Ovdim b'Yeretz Ashur. And then we have the tragedy, v'hanidachim b'Yeretz Mitzrayim. The Jews that were pushed away in lands of oppression, pushed away, punished, persecuted, murdered. How many Chabatnikim were executed by firing squads? The seventh Rebbe's own father died as a result of communist persecution. And the greatest miracle of all, these Jews, and we see it daily, American kids with everything in the world that is tangible, they give it up, come in Aliyah, become the finest citizens of Israel. Russians whose grandparents knew very little except that they had a Jewish heart. And they have blossomed and have guided and led the state of Israel at these moments in time. And above all, the great joy that today Haaretz newspaper, Shoken, jumping off the bridge because the multitudes are bowing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the holy mountain of Yerushalayim. Who would have guessed, mi Pilel umi Milel, that a day would come right now, here, happening, the head of the police, the head of the Mossad, the head of the Sheirut Bitachon Klali, the internal FBI as you call it in English, the Attorney General, endless advisors of Netanyahu, major generals in the Israeli Defense Forces, and the ultimate test of a religious Jew, Efafelt Nishta Mincha. To daven shacharit is very easy. You wake up. To daven maariv, when you're dead tired, all right, before you go to sleep, v'hu rachum. But mincha in the middle of the day, and all these people I've just mentioned, one of them happens to be a relative of mine, the head of the Mossad, they don't forget to daven a mincha. So, please join us, and if you can't, encourage your children. And if they can't, we want your grandchildren. It is our future. It is the survival of the Jewish people. And join us in bowing humbly before the Almighty for all the good He has vouchsafed unto us on the Holy Mount in Jerusalem. May you go, Michael Ochayel. The shul should have many, many members, tremendous support. And the Trumat Maisrat of your finest individuals should join us in Israel. A big Yashikayach, and I have the schut, I'm the first guest lecturer, am I right? In the new building. It is a great schut, and I have to thank two people, Raul Wallenberg for the Gluck family, and Semple Sugihara, that I am standing here. If anyone wishes to join us tomorrow, it's a closed lecture. I'm speaking again at the request of my students, how to raise Jewish children. Over Shabbat, I'm speaking in Halacha. I'm giving a shiur on Yantiv Sheni, which is a halachic dilemma that has no solution. And I'm giving a shiur on whether there can be differences of opinion in Halacha. Very important shiur. I'm also speaking on the Rav outside of the classroom as a human being. Sunday morning I'm giving a shiur on can we go up the Har Habayit, the Rambam, the Ravid, and all that's involved. Kedusha Tamakam, Yira Tamakam, and with that I collapse, get on the plane, and boy, when I face my class next Sunday, I will be rejuvenated, Be'ezrat Hashem, once again. I end off all my classes, you'll understand why, because you heard this lecture. You never heard this, this is 1981 post. Until we meet again, in health and happiness, das vidanya. Thank you very, very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi Rakefet. Thank all of you for coming. Just to clarify, make sure Rabbi Rakefet is giving his lectures in Young Israel of Hollywood over the weekend. So you're welcome to go up there and listen. And also want to remind you on your way out, please pick up flyers outside that will give you the information of further upcoming lectures here, as well as a Shabbaton coming up in two Shabbos Yishalach with Rabbi Muskin from California. And again, thank you for joining us, and thank you, Rabbi Rochefer.
Now, whose is this? No, what's that?
I want you